Hello, and welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. You can find more podcasts like this at www.educause.edu/podcasts. On this podcast, we present a keynote address from the EDUCAUSE 2009 Western Regional Conference. Our speaker is Brewster Kahle, director and co-founder, digital librarian, and chairman of the board for Internet Archive. His session is entitled, Toward Universal Access to All Knowledge.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be able to talk to a group that defined themselves as trying to think uncommon thoughts for the common good. What a great community to be a part of. And I appreciate you're letting me kick off your conference. It is an interesting time in the higher educational area, not just because the economic things. But some of the technologies make some things possible that we only really dreamed of before. And I'm going to try to argue that universal access to all knowledge is within our grasp. So if I'm successful out of this, then hopefully you'll say, you know, actually we could just do the whole darn thing. In fact, it's harder to go and think about how to not do the whole thing than just take it on and just finish this thing. So that's my goal. But I'm also going to go on to say a little bit of what some people are doing with these digital resources, because the only way to go and have universal access to this stuff is digitally. And sort of how are people coming to use these in new and different ways for scholarship and the like. And then end with some of the challenges, some of the things that are not going quite according to plan, if you will, and maybe what it is, the roles that you guys might be able to play towards actually seeing this stuff through. We are in the public sphere, and I think that we can, if working together, we can actually pull off something really quite grand. The Internet Archive is a nonprofit library. It's an independent library, so it was much more common 100 years ago before Andrew Carnegie brought all the libraries basically into the government or university realm. We're in the Presidio of San Francisco. We're about 40 people and about 160 people. Other people that are also scanning books in 18 locations. So we're a small entity, but we're trying to do something fairly large by working with others. And so hopefully you'll get a little bit of an idea of that as well. We see ourselves within a context of libraries. And I know that, you know, most of you guys are actually within the sort of the IT areas of the universities that you serve. But there's starting to be a real blur of information provisioning, digital services, and the like. Basically, as the IT areas have stopped as focusing as much on firewalls and, you know, just trying to get the plumbing to work at all, now that we're up at sort of the content layers, the library and the IT areas are starting to mesh, and I find that very exciting. And I like coming from a technical background to look back as sort of what tradition are we a part of now that we're working at this. And I like looking at what people carve in stone, what people actually want to see for a long time or they believe in very strongly. And carved above the door of the Boston Public Library is free to all. This is an institution, Boston Public Library, that was built by the most capitalistic, screw you people this country, this world probably has ever seen. Yet the idea of information having a different plane that it works on and role in society was baked into what it is they decided to endow and spend money on. So in that context, I'm going to suggest that universal access to all knowledge is within our grasp. And being an engineer, I'm going to do that sort of in that sort of engineering-ish way of go through, well, let's scope the problem. How hard is it? Where are we at this point? What are the big issues, technically as well as societally copyright policy type issues? So let's just break it up into the different media types. You know, it's kind of like the Amazon.com. There's books, music, video, and just go and scope the issues and try to go over what are the issues if we're trying to actually live up to this dream. If we're going to say all books, everything published ever, since Sumerian tablets, and try to make it so that it's accessible to anybody curious enough to want to see it, we have to sort of ask, well, how big is it? Well, the Library of Congress is about 26 million books, they say. 26 million books, and it's by far and away the largest library in the world. The next ones down are in the 15 million books area. So it's 26 million is by far and away the biggest library ever built by humans. But that's obviously not all books, so you got to guess beyond that. But why don't we just say, let's try to get the biggest library online of 26 million books. If we take a book is about a megabyte. So that's about, if you had a Microsoft Word, it's about a megabyte. 26 million books, 26 million megabytes, it goes mega, giga, tera. 26 terabytes would be all of the words in the Library of Congress. 26 terabytes is actually something you could go to Best Buy and buy at this point. 26, you know, it wouldn't set you back that much. In fact, it would probably cost less than a fancy car, or actually kind of any, just kind of an okay car. So you could have the cost of a car, you can actually have a copy of all the words in the Library of Congress. It's kind of neat. If there are scanned pages, like photograph pages, then it's larger and it depends on what resolution you're using. And it would go up from there. But we're still dealing with quantities of information that is within our grasp. What would you get for it? Well, we're starting to see these things come up. I mean, there are some massive projects that you know of, the Google projects, and there's Open Content Alliance and things. But we're starting to see these books kind of come around. Well, you can search inside the books, which is kind of cool. There are starting to be these open source page-turning type interfaces that are very booky, you know, so that you can search and it puts in little tabs and highlights for your search term. And they're very booky, and even they go so far as to turn pages, things like that. Very comfortable to deal with. And so that type of thing is coming around. When we were starting to do this, I was talking with the First Lady of Egypt, because we were doing some projects with them. She said, but I love my books. I have to say, I do too. And the idea of actually serving books again seemed to make sense. So we said, well, how hard would it be to make print-on-demand happen? It's always been promised, but how hard would it be if we just set out to do it? So we bought a van, put a satellite dish on it with a printer, binder, and cutter, and kids make their own books. It takes about 20 minutes to make a book, and it costs about $1 a book, about $1 a book for the parts cost. So $1 a book means that you can give books away. There's a study at Harvard said it costs $3 to loan out a book and get it back on the shelf. So it's cheaper to print it out and give it away. And if they want to bring it back so that you don't waste the paper, you can, but you don't have to really worry about it ever not coming back, which is a real fear that people have, and so that you can get these sorts of materials to a very broad population in a cost-effective way. And there's starting to be a few more bookmobiles. This is Eric Eldred, who is a named defendant in a case that went to the Supreme Court to try to help protect the public domain. We lost that one, but hopefully we'll do better in future court dealings. This is a couple of them launched in India. This is the opening day of a bookmobile in Alexandria, Egypt, to respond to the First Lady's request. There's an engineer working with one of the first kids using it, and a happy kid. So the idea that you can actually go and make these things available, even in those sorts of areas, was quite heartening. Now you say, well, this isn't quite my university concept, but the idea of applying this technology, if we can get it to work out in these sorts of environments, we can go and deliver books, if they want it as books, to people around campuses. We even went so far as to make a bookmobile in rural Uganda so that they were able to download, print, and bind. What we found is we didn't have the right books. So I'll go back to what it is we're trying to do towards that. But the technology worked pretty well. Since those days, there are now starting to be these print-on-demand and binding machines that sort of all-in-one. This is one of the first units from a group called On Demand Books. It cost about $100,000, and it's a printing binding machine so that you can go and out of this. It comes along, trims down a book, and out comes good-looking books. So I like that, but the area that I'm kind of excited about are the new netbooks. And the first of these netbooks, or sort of ebook reader type things, was the OLPC, the one laptop per child. And it spawned a whole bunch of more general purpose machines than just ones that are going for third world development. And these things are starting to become really cheap. So a couple hundred bucks, whether it's OLPC or these netbooks, is starting to get pretty good little form factor carryable things. And as I understand it, that's the cost of a couple of textbooks. So we're starting to get such that the computers as specialized devices as opposed to universal devices might be starting to come around, especially around reading things. So we're starting to see mechanisms of getting these things out there if we can get them into the computers. So we've tried out a few different mechanisms of doing that. One is by working with the Million Books Project in India and China, where it was a joint project with the United States under NSF funding, and we sent over scanners and sent over books. And what I learned out of it is mostly scan your own darn books. That they actually really did a very good job of scanning the books that were in India and China because they understood them, they knew how to deal with them, they knew how to source them. And the books that came from the United States libraries weren't actually up for going and giving their prize books over and the like. But in India, they scanned 600,000 books. In China, they scanned 1.4 million books. And the Chinese just okayed another $30 million to scan another 3 million books. So that's $10 a book is what they're allocating to go and do the next 3 million books in China. And we helped get a few scanners into the Library of Alexandria, and they've scanned about 50,000 Arabic books. When we said, let's try to do this within the United States to go and get this stuff up and running, we said, well, the labor costs cost a lot more relative to capital costs here, so can we go and make it so that it's faster from a people perspective by spending more on the technology? We tried using the Kirtas page-turning robots, and this was one of the very early ones, I think number 6 from their production lines. And we found that, at least at that time, they weren't terribly reliable and they were quite expensive. And they were about as labor-intensive as somebody turning the pages. So we went and designed a scanner that has two professional-grade digital cameras that take pictures of pages. And there's a pedal that raises and lowers glass to get the page really flat. The idea is to take a really good image as opposed to go take a bunch of images and then figure it out later. The idea is to take really good color photographs of these pages. And we have been setting up scanning centers in different places. There are now 18 scanning centers in 5 countries. Most of them are in the United States and Canada. But there are 18 of these things. And they're scanning 1,000 books a day. And what we've been able to do is get the cost down to 10 cents a page. So at 10 cents a page, that is cataloging, basically copy cataloging, digitizing, compressing it, sending it over the internet, running it through optical character recognition, packaging it as PDFs as well as online representations, putting it up again on the internet, and putting it in 2 continents. So for 10 cents a page, you can basically get a page online forever. And that's we've now gotten 1.3 million books up. We've scanned about 500,000 books out of that, and the others come from other projects, including Google's. So this is about 1.3 million public domain books are now available sort of as part of the commons. So we're still not where we need to be with 26 million books, but I'd say actually out of 10 million books, we're probably pretty much done. At that point, we could go to a scan on demand, that if particular people want those materials, but I'd say we're doing fairly well. So it's at $30, if it's 10 cents a page, and the average book is 300 pages, and it's $30 a book. So at $30 a book, $30 million for a million book library. And I asked the head librarian from Cornell, and they spend $55 million a year on their library alone, just that one library. All told, in the United States, we spend $12 billion a year on our libraries. $12 billion. $3 or $4 billion of that go to publishers' products, acquisitions budget. If we were to just put 5% of the top 100 libraries in the United States money into a bin, we would be done in 4 years. We'd have basically a digital library for us all, sort of within sort of, you know, reasonable shaving amounts of what it is it costs. So in other words, it's not that big a deal if we were able to act more centrally than we tend to do. We've also started going back for microfilm and microfiche. Gosh, I hated those things. But the idea, there's a lot of work that was done over the last several decades to go and make all of these microfilm and microfiche collections. There's now efficient technologies for getting these things online. Again, sort of 10 cents, and I think we could get it to go much faster. In other words, drop the costs to be able to get these materials online. So we can go and do all the newspapers, all the books, everything published in textual form and not break the budget. So the idea is 10 cents a page. We're going at 1,000 books a day. We've got over 1 million books now in 8 collections. And these are available for public downloading, for public reuse in the open sphere. So what the idea is, text is doable. If we wanted to go out, it would just take a couple of years for the public entities to take a small percentage of what it is they currently get, or even not that big a deal in terms of how much more money it takes to be able to digitize this large collections. So books all around are doable towards bringing online in a useful way. Audio. I'm going to move on to the next. So if we can do all books, can we do all the audio recordings? Well, you have to ask, how much is there? As best I can tell, in the largest collections of discs, 78 RPM records, long playing records, and CDs, it's 2 to 3 million of them. So 2 to 3 million of them. Fortunately, none of them are more than 150 years old, right? We started this fairly recently. And so there's just the published works of all audio is just not that big. And so it would take a few more of these cars full cars worth of hard drives to store it, but it's still not that big a deal. But unfortunately, it's a very heavily litigated area, especially around the music area. So we tried to find, how can we get going at this without spending a lot of years in jail? So we said, well, who's not actively served very well by the publishing system? And there are lots that actually want to have audio recordings out there. They're just not the mainstream, Madonna type records. And we started getting different collections from different communities that had music as a very big part of who they were, that not just as a commercial enterprise, not just for making money, but to be who they are. And this started to grow pretty well. But we really kick-started something when we got involved with the Rock and Rollers. So there's this tradition that the Grateful Dead started in the 1960s of allowing people to record their concerts and trade them with other people as long as no one made any money. Key, nobody made any money. And so, you could be a good deadhead by having a lot of tapes that were close to the originals and the like. When this moved onto the internet, they started doing the same sort of trading, but they had trouble because whenever they'd go and put up one of these big files, because they didn't believe in compression because that was degradation and stuff like that, they put up these big files, they would get shut down fairly quickly by their ISP or their university or the like. So one of our students that were doing our website said, there's this trading community. I said, I remember that. I used to have some Grateful Dead tapes back when I was in college. So it's still going strong. So he said, why don't we offer them a place in the archive? Why don't we help these guys out? So we wrote a note and said, would you be interested to this email list, it's how they coordinated each other, for unlimited storage, unlimited bandwidth, forever for free? They wrote back, we don't believe you. It's too big. It would be, it'll be too popular. You won't make it. I said, trust us. Well, let's try. If somebody says, they'd really like this to happen, they said, but if you could do this, it would be our dream. Good sign. So we tried. And we didn't just do any of the taper-friendly bands. They had to give some level more permission, because it was a little different than tape trading to go and put it on a central site, even if we didn't make any money off of it. And we started getting 2 to 3 bands a day saying yes. And the taper community started uploading 40 to 50 concerts a day. And it's been going on like that for years. We now have about 3,000 bands, and we have about 50,000 concerts, including everything the Grateful Dead ever did. And it hasn't sunk us. Yes, it's been interesting. Sometimes it's been a bit challenging. But we as a library, what are we here for in the digital realm? We're supposed to put things on our shelves and offer free public access. It shouldn't cost you to give something away. Right? In the United States, you get, if you give something to the public sphere or a charity, you get a pat on the back and a tax deduction. Except on the internet. If you tried to give something away by putting it on your ISP, if it gets popular, you can go broke. You can lose your house over trying to give something away. This makes no sense. So we said, why don't we just try to fix it by being standing in there and doing it with them? And it's worked out as actually a really good back and forth. And there's been issues around some of the legal issues, and we're much more prepared than a group of volunteers to be able to deal with it. It's just what it is we're here for. And it's all around worked. So getting all audio online, if we're starting with discs, it looks like it's about $10 a disc and about $10 for an hour of audio tape. So at that kind of cost, 2 to 3 million of them is $20 to $30 million one time, and we have all of the published works on discs available to the maximum extent allowed by copyright. Out of this time, we now have 100 collections and about 200,000 items, not just live music rock and rollers, but news reports and the like, and going and making this very broadly available. And helping people make collections that can last a long time. We find that volunteers really are willing to spend a lot of time and effort on things if they think what they're going to do is endure. And we actually, in the public sphere, have a mechanism of offering that kind of immortality and credit for their work if they were to go and do some of the collecting and organizing, which many of these communities are very happy to do. Moving images. If we wanted to say, let's take all moving images and try to make them available. Well, most people think of them as the Hollywood films, right? Sort of the theatrical releases. But as best we can tell, there are only 150,000 to 200,000 of those. Just not that many. Over half of them are Indian. So there are you know, a fairly small number of these, and they tend to be fairly reused. And we've only been able to find about 1,000 that are in the public domain. So volunteers have gone and digitized those and put them up on the Internet Archive. And we make them available as DVDs, DVD quality, as well as everything down to an iPhone quality or sort of flash YouTube-y-like thing. But they're quite popular. What we found even more popular out of this is the things you couldn't find anywhere else. These are the old archival films. The training films, the government propaganda films, those social behavior films. Remember those films when we were in junior high school? There was a substitute teacher and they'd wheel in that 16 millimeter. Those, we have those. Anyway, and so and these came from a guy's collection that he sells these things. And he's actually able to give them away on the internet and make money by selling stock footage through Getty Images. It's a two-tiered model, so it's working. He's making more money now that he's giving stuff away than he was before. Interesting that this two-tiered model, it doesn't always kill you to go and give something away. In fact, it actually can help. And these things have been rabidly popular. They've been getting millions of downloads. I'm not quite sure why. But sometimes they're being used for mashups and doing different things, or being used as kitschy things to go and broadcast on walls during in dance clubs. I think sometimes people are just trying to understand how the world used to work. And these sorts of films have a more raw view than Hollywood cut films. We also made offers to go and host other people's films for free. It's sort of YouTube before YouTube. YouTube has really basically taken the lines are the 99.9% of it, and we're pretty much left with the more archival, the longer form, the more scholarly types of materials, including Lego films. It turns out that you can take, if you take your Legos and take a still camera and take a picture and then bend them a little bit, taking the picture, and then you can make them look like they walk around. You put a soundtrack, you have a movie. Anyway, it's a whole genre. Who knew? Anyway, so they found us. So they started populating the Internet Archive with these, and we wrote back and started to try to support this community. It's another where you start to find communities that are grassroots that you wouldn't have set out. You wouldn't have been able to write a Mellon grant to go and say, I'd like to go and get support for this. But does it cost us much? No. So if we take a broad enough view of what our role is, then new things can happen and we can be a support for the new things that are coming around. Television comes larger. As best we can tell, there are 400 channels of television with sort of original programming. There's a lot of repeats all over the place. And I'm not quite sure what it's become as of late. But we started recording 20 channels of television, Russian, Chinese, Japanese, Iraqi, Al Jazeera, BBC, CNN, ABC, NBC, Fox, and just try to record it at DVD parameters 24 hours a day. It's a very big TiVo box. It used to be pretty hard because we did it onto tapes, but now with more recent technology, we're able to put it onto hard drives. And it's getting to be actually pretty reasonable in cost to be able to do this type of thing. Even a small organization like ours can take on doing a lot of this. We haven't made much of it available, somewhat for the rights issues, but mostly for the cost issues, at least for the television news. We'd really like to get back out there so that everybody could be a Jon Stewart. You know, the sort of the, this is what the guy said today. Here's what he said a year ago. It doesn't make any sense. You know, wouldn't it be great to be able to do more critiques? And if you can't quote something, then how are you going to be able to critique it? And television, and especially television news and government broadcasts, are so important that this is a type of resource that we should have available to all of our scholars within our communities. So we would be interested in partnerships to try to make more of this more globally available. We did make about a week's worth of this broadcast available. It was September 11th to September 18th, 2001. And we brought it up in October 11th, 2001. The idea is to try to get these, what did the world see? How did people react? And I think we're starting, especially in the United States, understand that news comes with a point of view, that just watching one station isn't going to do it, that you really need to be able to cross-compare different points of view. CNN at that time was saying Palestinians were dancing in the streets. Were they? Well, let's look at Palestinian television. How did they depict the events to themselves? And it wasn't a celebration. So yes, there might have been, but you know, who are we going to take their point of view? And I guess the real point is, let's not just have one, let's have many. So now that we have the ability to go and record these and make these things available for non-commercial use and loan digital copies, we can actually make these sorts of things available to ourselves if we step up to the plate and do it. So moving images, we've been finding it's about $15 per video hour to digitize and put on the net. We have 50,000, no, excuse me, I think we have a lot more than that now. We have over a million hours of television, and we're getting hundreds of videos being uploaded every day. We have about 150,000 items now in 100 collections. So it is possible to go on and try to do all moving image productions that are published that are going on. My penultimate software, there are only 50,000 titles of software. There are some issues around breaking copy protections, but we've been able to get copyright exemptions for doing that for preservation purposes. So the idea of running these on emulators and being able to preserve these is doable, but it's not being done much. Stanford has a great collection of software that they're really looking to preserve the cardboard boxes. They're not really working on trying to preserve the software itself. This doesn't make any sense. But it starts with a passion. It starts with somebody going saying, gosh darn it, we got to do this. And if one of you guys are that, or if you know somebody, we've got some great collections that we're trying to bring up and out there that are sort of old software and games and productivity suites on emulators in some way on the internet without violating copyright. What we're probably best known for is archiving the World Wide Web. I got involved in all of this, this whole internet thing back in the 80s to try to build the library. But by the mid-90s, we started to actually get enough publishing online to start to try to build that library. and so we started archiving the World Wide Web. We took a snapshot of every publicly available website every 2 months, not just the homepage, but all the images on it and every page within it that we could find, the whole thing. And it wasn't that many pages back in those days. And it's gotten to be fairly large as of late. We're collecting about 4 billion pages every 2 months at this point, and we're starting to do a lot more deep archiving of particular areas at a more rapid rate with librarian support with a project called Archive It. So these are services that the Internet Archive works with others, national libraries and university libraries, mostly some state libraries and archives, to go and build collections of materials that are very important to them. Now that publishing really has moved online, we have to start to take it much more seriously. Unless you're going to go out and grab it, it's going to go away. The average life of a web page, as best we can tell, is about 100 days. And there are about 50 million websites. So it's a big task, but you can start to take your particular areas and archive these materials and make them searchable again in interesting ways. This is what Yahoo looked like in 1996. It kind of looks clean like Google is today. Right? And it's interesting to see the evolution of these things. Oh, pets.com, remember the sock puppet guys? And we made it publicly accessible again on the Wayback Machine. Have people used the Wayback Machine? Oh, cool. Maybe, yeah, half, a little bit more. The Wayback Machine, you can type in a URL, and it gives you a list of all the past ones, and you can surf the web as it was. And we brought this out in 2001, and some lawyers thought that really bad things were going to rain down on us, right? That unless we went and got signed contracts in triplicate from every author on every website, we're going to end up, you know, having trouble. But since we're a nonprofit, we have no advertisements, we're very responsive. If people don't want it in there, we take it down. So we have sort of a rapid takedown policy. We've done actually just fine. And people send us more love mail than hate mail. And in fact, we get a couple 100,000 users a day. It's now a database of about 4.5 petabytes of information. So it goes mega, giga, tera. The next one is peta. So it's an enormous collection. It gets about 500 hits per second in terms of the requests per second. So it's an enormous database. I think it may be the largest single database ever. But it's an enormous collection. And here I went and looked up web.mit.edu, and you can see how dorky MIT's webpage looked like in 1996. So it is possible to go and record all of these things, even if you're a small organization such as ours. And we work with others to help support these types of services. Once you get it, what do you do with it? And it's been a little bit of a struggle. It usually starts with, oh my God, we've got to get that. And you get it, and then it's like, oh, well, now what? So we started out in 97 with a little tape robot. And that allowed us to get to 2 terabytes, which we thought was awfully darn great, until it started getting larger. And by 1999, we went to a larger tape robot that got us to 20 terabytes. And we really hated tape robots. They just don't work very well. They're not very reliable. So we, at that point, then we could start to move to disks. And here is a photograph of our first sort of disk-based system. And what we've found out of this is every time you move from one generation to the other, there's loss and risk. And it's not just technically things going wrong, it's people going wrong. Or funding kind of getting interrupted. Or somebody doing something that they thought was the right thing, but in retrospect, you wish they hadn't. And so if we're going to try to build a great library, and we're going to see ourselves in the great Library of Alexandria tradition, Library of Alexandria, which may have been the center of the ancient world's knowledge at the time, is best known for burning, right? It's gone. That thing is gone, gone, gone. There's only 8 pieces of papyrus that we think are alive today that had been in the Library of Alexandria. It's gone. So there's one idea is you go and take your big things and you put it and you bury it in the desert. Right? That's one way of preserving things. Another is to go and make copies and put them other places. And that's what we find that the right approach, or at least the approach that we're attempting. It's ever since Sumerian tablets, there's been some place up and running in the world. Right? When Europe went into its dark age for 1,000 years, it wasn't that interested in all of this stuff, there were up and running civilizations going on in other places. If we had made multiple copies of the Library of Alexandria, we'd have the other works of Aristotle, right? But they're gone. So our approach at this time was to try to make copies. And this is actually a photograph of what the Internet Archive looks like in the new Library of Alexandria. So we started a swap agreement. We gave them everything we had for a promise that they'll give us everything they have. So the idea is to swap. And we said, okay, why don't we do that in 5 or 6 places around the world? And if we can do that and have an enduring relationship, we think that we can not only back up their stuff, they can back up our stuff. And such that when the United States kind of goes through its hiccups and has some problems, more severe even than we have today, that when we come back up, hopefully they'll come back and say, I thought you might want these, and give us back our history. Because our history now is in digital form. And if we don't go and work very hard at keeping it around, it will go away. In 2008, we went on to build another generation of machines that got us to 2 petabytes of spinning storage. And this is actually located just a few blocks away from here. It's a data center that's at Second and Mission. And I would like to make an offer. If anybody would like to go and see a few petabytes of, you know, how the whole thing works, and our scanning center that's got 10 scanners that are scanning 150 books a day just within that scanning center, I would like to offer a tour that would leave here at 6 o'clock tomorrow night. After everything sort of simmers down here, if anybody that would be interested would gather, I think, probably here or right here? By the registration decks, and it's a 15-minute walk, and we'll go over there, and then you can go off to dinner. But it might be fun for the geeks among the crowd. You know, it's a special group that really like to go to a data center tour. But if you find yourself one of those, we can do it. So this is our last, and then 2 weeks ago, we announced a new generation of machine. It's a new generation of machine we're doing with Sun Microcomputers. Actually, we're attributed with coming up with the idea. They went and engineered and made a beautiful job of it. And it's a machine that's 20 feet by 8 feet by 8 feet. It's a shipping container, but we think of it as a machine. It is the Wayback Machine. It stores 3 petabytes of materials on 63 computers that are made up of cores and whatever. But we look at it as a machine, and it sits outside. Which is kind of cool. It sits outside. So you basically plug in cold water, fiber, and power. And this thing is a computer. Because I can't stand building data centers. I mean, they're just awful. I mean, they take forever. They cost a lot. You're either short on space or too much, or it's inappropriate, or you didn't put enough air conditioning. Blah. So these things, are a good next step for how buying machines might work. So it's a fairly large repository. It's 3 petabytes in size, but it's also very easy to maintain. So we were looking for easy to maintenance, low power, and low capital cost. And the capital cost at Sun, you have to bargain with them a bit, but it's actually a pretty good deal for going and maintaining this much data. It's made up of these Thumper machines that have 48 hard drives each. And they have this nice characteristic that if a drive goes bad, a little light goes on. It goes bleep, 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 replace me. Now you say, oh, isn't that cute, you know. But it's actually quite helpful because we're finding that actually it's human error that is the thing that drives data loss at this point. Yes, there are hardware failures, but it's trying to make things really easy to maintain over generations of people as they shift through is actually completely critical. Anyway, a good device for this. We want to see the next generation of the Internet Archive to look like the Jedi Library in Star Wars, but we're not quite here yet. Glowing books, quiet, no power, no big fans. Looks pretty great. We have one other start of an installation in Amsterdam, owned and operated by an independent group, because it's the only way to get things to work. So that's been our technology for going and keeping things around. You have to keep on top of it, keep moving technologies, and make copies. Making copies is egoful, very difficult from an ego perspective. You're taking what's most valuable to you and giving it to somebody really distant. It's hard, but I really recommend it. And if we can learn something from the biologists or the scientists, as opposed from the cultural institution's like, mine! but if the scientists and the seed banks are a bit more oriented towards sharing and making things available. I'm going to go on to say a little bit and just going to flash through some people that are making use of these materials in new and different ways. So Kathy Norton is the director of Marine Biological Laboratories at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. Great place to get stationed, don't you think? Woods Hole, great place. Anyway, so she's trying to help biologists make use of these digital materials. But the guys aren't looking for just getting a book and reading it in the traditional way. They're data mining. So they use the National Institute of Health's database of genetics to go and try to find people that lived longer than they should and try to find what's different about them. Then they started using her collection of digitized materials to try to find species that live longer than they should, to try to find, are there genetic things that we can learn about aging? But all of this requires digitized materials in the open that you can data mine freely and openly. Louis von Ahn, a professor at Carnegie Mellon, came up with an idea of using the people on the internet as a distributed computer. He's the guy that came up with those nasty little things to prove you're a person called CAPTCHAs. Those are those things on the bottom of e-commerce sites that you have to type in the letters that are, right, those. He came up with them. He's felt guilty ever since because it's wasting people's time. And so he said, well, why don't we have people be doing something useful? So he's using our book's digitization efforts. When the OCR package says they can't figure it out, he goes and puts them in front of people. Right? So prove you're a person. The computer couldn't do it, so you prove you're a person by telling us what the word was. And he's basically got this thing called ReCAPTCHA, and it's being used in correcting our books at a ferocious pace globally. So it's sort of interesting. He's gotten famous by going using people as a distributed computer. Right? So it's a cutting-edge computer science that's also doing something useful. Stephen Wolfram is founder of Wolfram Research that does Mathematica, which is this very cool program that knows a lot about math. The way that they teach it math at this point is they have the computer read math equations from papers. It knows the basics at this point, but it goes and scans math literature, does optical character recognition on the formulas, and makes sure his computer program understands all the math in the newest math papers. Cool. Again, this requires access to masses of material and doing something different with it than was originally done. So these digital libraries are being used for new and different ways. Greg Crane is a humanist, humanities professor at Tufts. He studies Greek and Roman literature. He's gone and taken a digital version, found all of the place names, and then plotted those on Google Earth. So if you wanted to go and find, not very good at my Greek literature, everything referring to Troy, you can go and zoom in on Troy, click on it, and see all of the references to Troy in the literature. It's just a new way of getting people involved with the literature and indexing in a new way if you have access to these materials in bulk. So it's key that we allow people to download and make access to these things in bulk. A couple more. Phil Resnick. He is University of Maryland, a linguist, and he's trying to teach the machines how to translate from one language to another. We already know do the dictionary thing and a little grammar, but what you really need at this point is a lot of parallel corpuses, things that were written in English and French, and then have the computer learn from how people had done the translation. They can get the nuances. They just need a lot of text. And he's been mining the Internet Archive to be able to get these materials out to feed to his computer programs. I talked about the Uganda project. And last, Larry Lessig has been using these materials to try to data mine to find what are the out-of-copyright books out there according to U.S. law. So he needed access to library catalogs. It turns out that's hard to get. It's really pretty much controlled by OCLC. Which is kind of a nonprofit, but they're really not that interested in sharing. So if you want to go and get access to these things in bulk, we go back to the original libraries, and they give us collections of these materials. And then people like Larry Lessig go through and try to find what's under copyright and not. And we are interested in library catalogs in a way that I'll say in a moment. This project is called the Open Library Project. The idea is to build one web page for every book. It's trying to build a Wikipedia of books. How do we get books to the Wikipedia generation? I don't think they're going to be going to the reference desk and going through the stacks. They're not doing that much anymore. So how, if we're going to bring books online, how do we bring it to them? And we've got to use their newest tools. And wiki-type tools are a good start. So we've made a site that's an open-source software site. It's a community-built site. Called Open Library. It's in very much in beta. need some help on this. We have 22 million records from donated records for catalog records. So we're getting there, right? If Library of Congress has 26 million books, it turns out they only have about 12 million books in their catalog. And the rest of the collections we're getting from libraries like yours. And we have indexed, full text indexed, 1 million books that are on this site, freely accessible. And you can go and download these catalogs or the software or use it or help build it. It's wiki editable, not only the text of it, but also the code on it is wiki editable. So it's a project that I hope that you guys might be able to use within your communities as being a free and open access tool, or you can take the software and use it for whatever you want to do to be able to bring some of these digital materials to your user populations. And I'd like to make a pre-announcement. So it's a pre-announcement because it's really quite beta. But we're building an open repository for the commons, for you guys. So our machinery will be more and more accessible just as a normal repository. We're implementing the S3 protocol, the Amazon S3 protocol. So if you have an S3 client, and there are now starting to be a lot of things that use that, do people know what S3 is? No. Amazon.com has made open storage, so you can go and put things on their servers easily. It's called like a remote NFS. It's sort of like a global repository, but it's fairly private oriented. It's really oriented towards putting your stuff someplace you can get it back from. It's hosted storage, and the protocol is called S3. They've also made EC2, which is how to do remote computation. It's becoming very, very popular. And so we're implementing that as well, so if you don't want to put it on Amazon for a fee, you can put it on us for free. The thing that we tend to want to do, though, is make it as broadly available as possible. So if you're starting to build repositories, you might want to consider using these services. It's Fedora. We're putting a Fedora layer and a Zotero layer on this as well to help people be able to put things into it. And if you upload things like digitized papers from JSTOR, we'll OCR it for you so that you can go then and use it for searchability and the like. So it's sort of value-added global commons. And if this is useful to you, please let us know. We're looking to increase the number of people slowly that are starting to use this as we're debugging it. So building the library. I'd say all of us are in the library world now. You may think of yourself as an IT person, but it's now the library world. We're at the content layer. We've gotten the plumbing going. The software is kind of working okay. We're really trying to get some of the information services going. To have that happen within ourselves, we have to go and start to build digital services ourselves. Or we're going to end up having to buy it from other companies. Our approach is to digitize the library and make it available, and to try to get new materials into our repositories to keep them in the public sphere. Let's give away everything that's in the public domain and loan everything else. That's the answer, I believe, to the copyright issue, is let's act like a library. We loan things. That's what we do. And so there's all this sort of, well, do we own it in the sense that we get, you know, releases for every bit, which way? You're never going to get there. We're going to have stuff in our collections that it's just going to be unclear. Well, let's loan it. We may not be able to say anybody can do anything they want with it after the fact, but let's go and make it available. Let's encourage bulk use. This is absolutely key. I'd suggest that that's really what open means. But the existing library system is imploding. It's starting to really break down. We're starting to basically transition from when we were in physical assets, from local control, nonprofit, diverse, and ruled by law. But now as we move through a digital transition, it's going to central control, whether it's through Elsevier, Google, whatever, LexisNexis, usually driven by for-profits, tends to be homogeneous. The same services are offered to everybody. It's ruled by contract, not by rule by law, and it's closed. So what do you do about this? Well, let's go and build the open versions. We're starting to be offered open, and everything's called open. It's sort of like the new E. You know, it's starting to not mean much. But I thought I'd try to drive this home. Google has been getting a lot of libraries to sign up for open access. But in there are these different clauses in the contracts, like the university shall develop methods and systems for ensuring that substantial portions of the universal digital copy are not downloaded or otherwise disseminated to the public at large. Doesn't sound too open to me. Or shareable. You're allowed to share up to 10% of your works. This is, again, quoting Google. Often Elsevier and those guys are much worse. Prior to any distribution, but the university or recipient, Google, must have entered into a written agreement on terms acceptable to Google. In other words, they have prior restraint on any sharing. This doesn't make any sense. It's not what it is we've learned and what we're here to build. Let's build the university system, the library system, excuse me, that we've dreamed of. There's now an organization called the Open Content Alliance, which is gets together every October in San Francisco of people that are trying to build joint repositories of collections of cultural artifacts. If you're interested, that's an organization. It's free, and it's an open meeting to come and share ideas and share experiences. But it's really for the builders, though, that want to build the public version of the library system that we, frankly, grew up with. Universal access to all knowledge. I tried to argue that it's within our grasp, that it's technically doable. Great things are being done with it. And I'd suggest it could be one of the greatest achievements of humankind. It could live on like the Library of Alexandria, Gutenberg Press, Man on the Moon, as one of the greatest things people have ever done. To end with another carved above the stone. Carved above the stone of the Carnegie Library in Pittsburgh is free to the people. Thank you very much.
Brewster Kahle, director and co-founder of the Internet Archive. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE. Thanks for listening.